Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Lethal Injection Protocol Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 29, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Glossop v. Gross. This case concerns three questions. The first is whether it is constitutional for a state to execute an inmate by administering a three-drug protocol in which, A, there is some scientific agreement that the first drug does not sufficiently relieve pain or consistently render a person in a deep state of unconsciousness, and B, that there is a substantial risk that administration of the second and third drugs would cause significant pain to a still conscious prisoner. The second question is whether the plurality stay standard of Bays v. Rees is applicable when states are using a different execution protocol than the one involved in Bays v. Rees. The third question is whether, if a state's protocol for lethal injection will violate the Eighth Amendment, the legal duty to propose a different drug falls upon the prisoner. To discuss the case, we have John Stiniford, who is an associate professor of law and assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Stiniford.
The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution states that excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. About 7 years ago, in the case of Bays versus Rees, there was a challenge made to the constitutionality of the three-drug cocktail used for lethal injection. And the basis of the challenge was this. If, in fact, the prisoner is not put in a deep, unconscious state at the time the paralyzing agent or the heart-stopping agent are used, there is a very great likelihood that the offender will suffer a terrible death. Again, the paralyzing agent makes it feel as though the offender is being suffocated to death, very much like the gas chamber. And the heart-stopping agent, the sodium chloride, makes it feel like they're getting burned to death from the inside. It's been described as having liquid fire poured into your veins. And so the barbiturate was used as a way of inducing unconsciousness so that the offender would not feel the extreme pain and suffering that would come from the other two drugs in the drug cocktail. So in Bays versus Rees, the Supreme Court held that there was not a substantial risk that the three-drug cocktail would cause an unconstitutional level of pain or suffering as part of the execution process. And on the other hand, a method that might pose such a risk might be unconstitutional. Well, so what happened in the years after Bays versus Rees is that it became increasingly difficult for states to get their hands on barbiturates that could be used to put the offender into a coma-like state. The two main types of barbiturate that have been used in the past both became unavailable, largely through the pressure of anti-death penalty advocates who convinced the companies that produced these drugs to keep them from being available to the state. And so the state of Oklahoma and a couple of other states as well switched from the barbiturates to an anti-anxiety medication known as midazolam, and they used midazolam to induce unconsciousness prior to the administration of the other two drugs. The concern about midazolam is that there have not been any studies showing that it's capable of actually producing the deep coma-like state that barbiturates can produce. It will make someone unconscious, but it's not clear whether the level of unconsciousness is such that it can't be overcome once the severe pain occurs when the other two drugs are administered. Well, the case of Glossop versus Gross involves several different petitioners, all of whom committed a murder in very horrific manners. One of them committed a murder by hire, where they hired someone to essentially beat their employer to death. Other petitioners killed young children, sometimes in very gruesome ways. So the narrow issue in this case is whether, in fact, the use of this drug, midazolam, to induce unconsciousness creates an unconstitutional level of risk that the other two drugs in the three-drug cocktail will cause pain and suffering as part of the death process. the district court, after hearing both the expert for the petitioners and the expert for the government, essentially sided with the government and found that the government's expert was correct and that there was no substantial risk that the midazolam would not put the offender in a sufficiently deep unconscious state to eliminate the risk of pain and suffering. I think one broad issue that underlies the whole debate about lethal injection that is often ignored by both the court and the media is the distinction between punishments that actually inflict pain and those that appear to be painful or violent. And sometimes a punishment can appear to be painful or violent, but not actually inflict very much pain. For example, hanging, if done properly, or even a firing squad, may provide instantaneous death with relatively little pain, but it's very violent and unpleasant to watch. On the other hand, we have punishment methods like lethal injection that may appear on the surface to be very peaceful, but may in fact inflict a great deal of pain on the offender. And so one question that might arise is, well, why? Why would we replace a painless but a violent-looking punishment with one that looks peaceful, although it may in fact impose great pain? And I think the reason for that is that for political reasons, the government wants to essentially hide from the people the nature of what happens during capital punishment. If you look to sort of the early history in the 20th century, the movement from death by hanging to the electric chair was moved forward by public outcry after some mishaps during hangings that resulted in horrible, violent deaths. And the government's main interest was not so much in making sure that the offenders didn't suffer, but in making sure that the offenders did not appear to suffer. In fact, even in the 1970s, you know, one thing that's interesting about the history of lethal injection is that it's very clear, and it always has been clear from the beginning, that there was no need for a three-drug cocktail. That is, you could administer barbiturates alone in a sufficient dosage. And if you just use the barbiturates, you could kill the offender every time, and you could do so in a painless manner. So the question arises, well, why not just use barbiturates from the beginning? I mean, this shortage of barbiturates has only come up in the last few years. Why were we using the paralyzing agent and the heart-stopping agent? And I think there are two reasons for that. One is to make it quicker. Right? The barbiturate might not act as quickly as the heart-stopping agent, for example. And number two, it was to avoid the appearance that the offender actually died, and instead to make it look more like the offender went to sleep. If you just use a barbiturate to execute an offender, one of the things that happens before they die is they go through the death throes where the body seizes up. It's very unpleasant to watch. It's very violent looking in a way that's similar to death by hanging or firing squad. So although the offender doesn't feel any suffering, those who have to watch the execution have to watch something gruesome. And so steps have been taken essentially to enable us to hide from ourselves the real nature of what executions are. They are, in fact, a violent act. They involve the taking of a life, but we use the three-drug cocktail, and especially the paralyzing agent, to make it appear that the offender is going to sleep. The ironic part of it, of course, is that the very agent that makes it look like they're going to sleep is the thing that causes the risk of pain. At least it's one of the two things that causes the risk of severe pain. The petitioner's argument is that at least this procedure creates a substantial risk that the government is torturing him to death. Again, the problem is you can't know for sure whether that's happening because the paralyzing agent prevents the offender from responding to pain. But the notion is if you only used the paralyzing agent and the heart-stopping agent, that clearly would be death by torture because, again, it would feel like you're being simultaneously drowned and burned to death at the same time. It's a very horrific way to die. And, of course, burned to death from the inside while you're drowning. So the notion is the constitutionality of this process completely depends on the effectiveness of the agent that is supposed to render the offender unconscious. But the question here is, what about other drugs, such as the anti-anxiety drug midazolam? Are they sufficiently powerful to eliminate that risk of pain and suffering? One final issue that's raised in the briefs in this case is whether the petitioner should be required, in order to prevail, to offer an alternative method of execution that would be feasible and would be constitutionally acceptable. Based on some language in Bays versus Rees, the government has argued that unless the plaintiffs are willing to identify another method of execution that the state can feasibly employ and that the petitioner would not consider inherently cruel, they should not be able to even raise the claim that this particular method is unconstitutionally cruel. I think the petitioners are clearly correct that the government can't plausibly make the claim that any method of punishment they choose is immune from constitutional review unless the offender is willing and able to come up with an alternative means of punishment that would pass constitutional muster. In other words, imagine a situation where the government decided that it was going to execute everyone by burning them alive, and the petitioner tried to argue that that was cruel and unusual. If the government responded to that by saying, well, you can't argue that burning people alive is cruel and unusual unless you're willing to tell us what method of punishment you will accept, right? On the face of that, that seems rather implausible. Either a punishment is unduly harsh or it's not for constitutional purposes. On the other hand, I think the government is clearly correct that the litigation in this case is part of a broader strategy to eliminate the death penalty by eliminating acceptable methods of execution from the system, either by having the court declare them unconstitutional or by pressuring manufacturers not to provide the drugs necessary to impose the punishment constitutionally. Again, at the end of the day, I don't think that the strategy behind this litigation should affect the way the court treats the underlying constitutional issue, which is whether this particular method imposes an unduly substantial risk of pain and suffering. If the court finds that it does, it should be held unconstitutional regardless of what the underlying motives or strategy of the anti-death penalty movement might be.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.